The German Question by Richard Bernstein. 'Tis not often that world leaders are bluntly contradicted in public by other world leaders, but that is what happened at the Bayerischer Hof, Munich's grand 19th century hotel, where a bit over a year ago, in what came to be an almost epical event in Germany, Secretary of Defense Donald H. Rumsfeld and Germany's Foreign Minister, Joschka Fischer, has a sort of clash of civilizations over the war in Iraq. The setting was the 2003 Munich Conference on Security Policy, an annual event attended by a who's who of European and American diplomacy, business, and politics. At the time, Rumsfeld was at the height of his European unpopularity, thanks to his statements likening Germany to Libya and Cuba in their non-support of what was then the imminent Iraq War, and his declaration that old Europe was irrelevant. As Rumsfeld spoke, demonstrators led by Munich's mayor gathered on the snowy streets of the city. Munich, of course, is a historically and metaphorically freighted place, the city where Neville Chamberlain made his notorious gesture of appeasement to Hitler, and that was Rumsfeld's theme as he made the case for the war. To fail to overthrow the regime of Saddam Hussein, he argued, would be to fail to learn the lesson of Munich. Rumsfeld then sat in the front row of the audience, his face set in an almost theatrical glower, as Fischer took the podium to argue the contrary point of view. An intensely intellectual man, who happens to be both a former street-fighting left-wing radical and Germany's most popular politician, Fischer argued what had by then become the standard old European point of view, that starting a war against Iraq before the peaceful alternatives had been exhausted was both unnecessary and rank with possibilities for unintended consequences. In mid-speech, Fischer broke into extemporaneous English. "Excuse me," he said, while Rumsfeld sat and glared, "but I'm not convinced." The phrase, reproduced in English, in the headlines of many German newspapers the next morning, quickly acquired an almost Delphic significance in Germany as a declaration of independence from the United States, the endpoint of a half century of nearly automatic compliance with the American wish. Effusions of joy greeted the comment all over anti-George Bush and anti-Rumsfeld Germany. But by the time of the next Munich Security Conference, in February, the atmosphere was much changed. There were no mass demonstrations outside the hall, and no abrupt confrontations within. Of course, there were reminders of the disagreements of the past. We were not, and are still not, convinced of the validity of the reasons for war, Fischer said. Yet he avoided repeating the old arguments. He has said frequently that the debate over Iraq was always a matter of tactics, not goals, and that even though the United States went ahead with a war that Germany opposed, it is now in the German interest for the Americans to succeed. It is certainly not in Germany's interest for its major ally, the United States, to become bogged down in a quagmire. Fischer used his Munich appearance to put forward a strategic vision that is actually very close to the American one. "We face a common threat," Fischer said, and he attached a clear name to it. Destructive jihadist terrorism, with its totalitarian ideology. Facing that threat, Fischer declared, it is imperative that the coalition's efforts must be successful, the forces of violence and terror in Iraq must not win the upper hand. Fischer's Munich 2004 speech was clearly an attempt to realign Germany with the United States, after the worst period in their relations since the end of World War I. A few months during which President Bush didn't talk to Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder. A few weeks after this year's Munich conference, in fact, Schroeder went to Washington and, in a public display of camaraderie with President Bush, seemed to put the freeze of 2003 into the past. The Chancellor proposed a sort of Marshall Plan for the Muslim world, a multifaceted effort that was first outlined by Fischer in Munich to address the poverty and desperation that are, in the German view, at the heart of the problem. But Fischer understands, and has said, that winning the war on terrorism will require something more than a program for what he calls the modernization of the Islamic world. You fight terrorism with police, with armies, with intelligence, but also with transformation, and by addressing the root causes, he has said. His belief, and Germany's belief, is that the old transatlantic alliance is indispensable, probably for both sides, certainly for Germany. So the question is, is everything back to normal between the United States and Germany? Given Germany's centrality to the Western Alliance's entire network of agreements and institutions, it is an important question at any time, but it seems especially important in the wake of the devastating terror attacks in Madrid on March 11. Germany is the geographical, economic and strategic heart of Europe, and it will be even more so, as the European Union, newly enlarged from 15 to 25 members, strives to forge common positions in foreign affairs and defense. For 40 years, what was then West Germany was, outside of England, America's closest European ally, our chief Cold War partner, the country that owed its flourishing and vigorous democracy to what might perhaps be the most benign and successful post-war occupation in history. Germany is the country that has always prevented France from transforming the European Union into an instrument of French policy, which was, and still seems to be, to create a counterweight to the American superpower. Germany has always been, so to speak, the counterweight to the counterweight, the rudder that has kept the alliance on course. It is this background that makes the question of German-American relations so important once again as the West confronts Islamic terrorism. The people on both sides of the Atlantic now understand that they are vulnerable to what Fischer has aptly called a transmogrified sort of totalitarianism, which strikes in a new, terrifying, random and unpredictable way. So, yes, normal relations between Germany and the United States have been restored, but with some new uncertainties and questions. There is no important disagreement between the United States and Germany, or the rest of Europe, over the existence and nature of the terrorist threat. But the freeze of 2003 resulted from some deep disagreements over the tactics to adopt against the threat, and these disagreements are rooted not just in different conceptions of the role of force, but also in the widespread conviction that Europe and the United States belong to two very different universes of culture and values. European governments, in the wake of the Madrid bombings, have mostly reaffirmed their solidarity in the anti-terror fight. Even the newly elected Spanish Prime Minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, pledged his support, despite his plans to withdraw his country's military contingent from Iraq. But as Zapatero's victory itself suggests, some Europeans seem to believe that the more they distance themselves from American policies, the safer they will be. In this context, the German-American relationship will determine much about the endurance and effectiveness of the transatlantic alliance that won the Cold War, kept the peace, spread democracy throughout Europe, and is now being called on to protect the West, and the penumbra of states dependent on it from the new menace of terrorism. There was a telling moment at Munich 2004 that indicates some of the ways in which German-American ties are still weaker than they were before the divisions over the war in Iraq. It came when William Cohen, former Secretary of Defense, did a bit of politely phrased public grilling of Fischer. If Germany agrees that it is essential to win the peace in Iraq, and if winning the peace is so essential to the security of Europe and America, Cohen asked, why would Germany rule out sending troops to Iraq to help the coalition in its struggle? Germany, as Cohen surely knew, has stated clearly that it will not send a single soldier to Iraq. With troops already stationed in places like Bosnia and Kosovo, in addition to Afghanistan, where more than 2,000 German soldiers serve in the NATO-commanded international force, German officials persuasively make the point that their contribution to European peacekeeping and the war on terrorism is being made elsewhere. Germany has agreed to run a training program for Iraqi police officers, though not in Iraq itself, and figures like Fischer have certainly made clear that they want the United States to prevail in making Iraq a self-sustaining democracy. To the critics of the Schroeder government, however, Germany's vigorous campaign in the United Nations and NATO against the war in Iraq was behavior unbefitting an ally. There has of course been opposition, even very passionate opposition, to the United States in the not-too-distant German past. J. Just look at the protests during the Vietnam War, when the posters showed the letters USA written so that the S looked like a swastika, or the mass marches against the installation of Pershing I medium-range nuclear missiles on German soil in the early 80s. What was different in the Iraq debate was that opposition to a policy that the United States deemed critical to its national interest was headquartered in the German government itself, in the office of the Chancellor. By contrast, Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, who, as a Social Democrat was himself on the left, supported the installation of the missiles in the 80s. Schroeder not only spoke out strongly against the war, but also was the first major European leader to do so, inveighing against it at a time when President Jacques Chirac of France seemed uncertain what to do. Then he went further than Chirac ever did, saying that Germany would oppose a war even if the United Nations sanctioned military action. It was Schroeder, not Chirac or President Vladimir Putin of Russia, who crystallized what came to be called the Moscow-Berlin-Paris anti-war axis, and it was this tripartite opposition that made Security Council approval of the American plan well nigh impossible. Worst of all, perhaps, Schroeder did this not by leading German public opinion, but by following it at a time when anti-American sentiment had reached a post-war peak. As Michael Mertz, a former foreign policy advisor to Chancellor Helmut Kohl, put it in an article in the journal Internationalpolitik, if anti-Americanism pays domestically, how reliable is Germany as an ally when the moment of truth finally comes? It is one of the paradoxes of the Iraq debate that despite Germany's more categorical opposition to war, Americans were, and still are, far angrier at France. One explanation for this is that as the debate heated up in the early months of 2003, Germany happily allowed France, mostly in the person of its flamboyant foreign minister, Dominique de Villepin, to lead the coalition of the unwilling. When de Villepin was applauded after a rousing anti-war speech in the Security Council, Fischer knew immediately that it was going to be very expensive applause, expensive in American annoyance. Fischer has told German journalists that in his own speeches he tried to remain academic, precise, a little bit boring. He acted that way mainly because he had no interest in allowing the war in Iraq to spoil the bilateral relationship, but also because of the ineradicable German instinct, since World War I, to play a subdued role on the world stage, not to be like France. The German interest since the end of the war has been to allay fears that someday it will allow history to repeat itself, to create a Fourth Reich, to use its power to dominate Europe. It wants, as conspicuously as possible, to be non-nationalistic, non-militaristic, anchored in Europe, and in the NATO alliance. This does not mean that Germany and its foreign policy have been static since 1945. The fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 fundamentally altered the strategic equation that had governed both German-American relations and Germany's own single-issue foreign policy for more than 40 years. Almost overnight, Germany was under no military threat. After the fall of the wall, said Carsten Voigt, the German Foreign Ministry's coordinator for German-American cooperation, Germany became less dependent on the United States, but we became less relevant to the United States at the same time. In fact, the disappearance of the Cold War threat and German reunification have brought changes, most notably a slow but steady German progress toward being what the Germans often call a normal country, a country like others, even though the Germans seem to understand that the mere fact that they aspire to be normal means that in at least some ways they still can't be. The Germans move slowly and hesitantly toward accepting that their country has interests and responsibilities, like other countries, even as they worry that their past disentitles them to have these things. The liberation of Germany from its American dependency also brought it into confrontation with an unknown. Before, it was automatic that we would be part of the game, Voigt said, meaning the Cold War game. Now, we have to decide if and where we want to be relevant. It's a psychological shift. We need to change the mentality of the German people, not just the mindset of a few leaders. Among the main things that had to change was the almost theological pacifism of the German public that recoil from the horrors that the Germans once inflicted on the Jews, on their European neighbors, and on themselves. We have an excellent democracy, but there are terrible things in our past, Fischer once said to me, and that sentence is indeed German history, in a nutshell, the bad followed by a real attempt to come to grips with what went wrong, and to not repeat it. But at the same time, once democracy was firmly established, and once the Western Alliance needed a German military contribution, the pacifism that was once a reassurance became a kind of failing. Germany's pacifism was a relic of a moral superiority for Germany, another kind of arrogance, said Heinrich August Winkler, one of Germany's most prominent historians. It was the inverse of the former German arrogance, vastly better, but an arrogance nonetheless. By all accounts it has been Fischer, the foreign minister, who is chiefly responsible for ridding Germany of this post-war legacy. Fischer's biography is one of those things that everybody in Germany knows, a sort of metaphor for Germany itself and its transformation. He is a member of the generation born just after World War I, which demanded an accounting of Germany's wartime crimes and forced the previously taboo subject of the Holocaust into the open. As a teenager, unable to tolerate the conformity demanded in the schools, he dropped out, became a political radical, and then, in the early 80s, a member of the nascent Green Party, the peace and environmentalist group, whose members wore jeans, listened to Dylan, and, in some cases, breastfed their babies during meetings. In other words, Fischer belonged to a movement that failed in its stated objective, notably to bring about a revolution, but nonetheless fractured Germany's formerly stiff, heel-clicking authoritarianism, and led to its replacement with a more open, more democratic, and, above all, more self-critical society. When Fischer became Environment and Energy Minister of the State of Hesse, in 1985, he famously wore sneakers to his inauguration, and the shoes, emblems of Germany's cultural transformation, are now on permanent exhibit in the Historical Museum in Bonn. The whole leftist movement was a failure, said Otto Schily, Germany's interior minister, who was once a lawyer for members of the terrorist Red Army faction. But the result, the transformation of the German collective consciousness, was a success. Fischer never seemed primarily interested in green issues, most notably the environment, though certainly the Greens were the only party unorthodox enough to allow a high school dropout like him to rise to power. His interest was in foreign policy, the Middle East, in German relations inside Europe, and, of course, in doing well enough in elections to become part of the national government. He and the Greens did so in 1998, coming to power as the minor partner in coalition with Schroeder's Social Democrats, what's known locally as the Red-Green Coalition. Once Fischer was in power, his former radicalism continued to fade, and he became a liberal interventionist, in favor of the use of force, when all other options have been exhausted. Specific events pushed him along, especially the Serbian massacre of some 8,000 Bosnian Muslims, in the supposed United Nations safe area of Srebrenica, in 1995, and later the Serbian threat of ethnic cleansing against Albanian Kosovars, in 1998. Both incidents left a deep mark on Fischer, who led the Greens, kicking, screaming, and protesting, away from pacifism to an acceptance of the use of military force outside Germany's borders. When German pilots took part in the 1995 NATO bombardment of Serbian positions in Bosnia, it was the first time German forces had been used in a combat situation outside Germany since World War I. Essentially, Fischer brought the left into line with a foreign policy favoring a stronger and more active German role in the transatlantic alliance, and in so doing, he helped enable two German chancellors, Kohl, from the right, Schroeder, from the left, to engage German troops abroad without instigating mass demonstrations and mass resistance at home. September 11, 2001, moved Germany even further in the direction of greater engagement in the world and solidarity with the United States. Most important, Germany dispatched troops all the way to Afghanistan. Defense Minister Peter Strzok offered a succinct definition of Germany's new strategic position. Our security must also be defended on the Hindu Kush, he said in December 2002, referring to the Afghan mountain range. We must face up to threats where they arise, he said more recently. Strzok would have committed political suicide if he'd said that a few years before, Voigt said. We are now defining our security way outside our boundaries, and I think the German people will have to accept it, he continued. It's no longer a debate about morality, which it used to be previously. It's now a debate about interests. These days, Germans do indeed debate their interests, especially when those interests involve the United States. After September 11th, for example, Schroeder criticized the foreign policy of the preceding government of the conservative Chancellor Helmut Kohl for undertaking only secondary assistance measures. Schroeder said he would have Germany behave like a great power. But then came August 2002, when Schroeder himself, campaigning hard for re-election as Chancellor, announced his fundamentalist anti-Iraq war position, and soon thereafter, Schroeder, Chirac, and Putin created their own alliance, whose main purpose, it was feared in Washington, would be to confront any unilateral exercise of American power. Both sides became very ideological, articulating positions rather than searching for the truth, said Gary Smith, the director of the American Academy in Berlin, of the fierce disagreement over Iraq. And both sides indoctrinated themselves, they imbibed what they said at the time, and it's naive to think that suddenly their side is going to go back to the way they saw things before. Indeed, it is not difficult to find reasons that Germany and the United States may slowly drift apart, at least enough to end up on opposite sides of more than just the Iraq war question. Already the Germans share the wider European sense of a growing cultural gap with the United States, seen in disagreements over such matters as the death penalty, the Kyoto Protocol, on global warming, and the International Criminal Court. On all three, Europeans and Americans have opposing positions. There is also what has become the four-year-old stagnation of the German economy. The specter of 10% unemployment and the prospect of a shrunken social security system will probably dampen the German enthusiasm for more foreign engagements or new troop deployments. It all comes together, and it gives you the feeling that there's less common ground than there used to be, said Wolfgang Biermann, a Social Democratic Party senior foreign policy advisor. The feeling in Germany is that the Americans end up doing what they want with only their national interest counting. While the Germans don't feel that only their national interest counts. Finally, Germany has new distractions and new priorities, most important the effort to build an integrated Europe. It is a project that doesn't necessarily mean it drifting away from the Atlantic Alliance, but many people suspect that the future will be determined by a contest between the German transatlanticists, who see the American relationship as fundamental, and the Europeanists, who see the future with a European Union. I'd say that, essentially, the non-Atlanticists have won, said Jeffrey Gedman, director of the Aspen Institute, Berlin. The deans of the Social Democratic Party are not anti-American, but none of them are full-blooded, heart and soul Atlanticists. They're at least as interested in the EU as they are in an alliance with the United States. More generally, Gedman said, German foreign policy in the next 10 years will look more French. The Germans will still be allies. They'll still be members of the alliance. But Germany will be far from the old, loyal, helpful junior partner it was under Kohl. Many Germans, including Fischer himself and his counterparts in the conservative opposition, repudiate the notion that foreign policy either can or should drift into a sort of Kohlism by default. This is a complete misunderstanding. He told me Germany is completely different, he said, meaning different from France, and the difference lies, as so much does in Germany, in the burden of the past. We have the responsibility of having fought for hegemony in the first half of the 20th century. We destroyed ourselves during the Nazi dictatorship. We are responsible for the Shoah. Our country was divided. And post-war Europe was not only built against the Soviet Union, but also against the German threat. So, yes, we'd be more Gaullist if we hadn't had the Nazi period and the Second World War. Of course, why not? Because then we would have had a different history. But given our real history, we don't only look to the transatlantic relationship because it's in our interest, but also because it is in our institutions. It is part of our way of life. There are large areas of strategic consensus rebuilding Afghanistan, bringing Turkey into the EU, in part to prevent it from drifting toward Islamic fundamentalism, keeping Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. More important is the widespread assumption in Germany, despite the jaundiced view millions of Germans still take of the Bush administration, that the United States must remain Germany's most important ally. If, as many expect, the conservative parties come into power in the next national elections in 2006, Germany would probably be more transatlanticist than before. If you try to unite Europe against the United States, you will fail, said Wolfgang Schäuble, vice chairman of the Christian Democratic Union, Germany's largest conservative party. Most people in Germany understand that the better way for Germany is to cooperate very closely with the United States. Without a strong partnership, it would be much more difficult and much more insecure for us. Perhaps the key concept for the future is very simple: a less compliant, more European-oriented Germany is the almost inevitable price that the United States will pay for one of history's greatest foreign policy triumphs, the forging of a peaceful, democratic, united Germany. For the first time in modern history, Germany is surrounded by friendly countries. It has no territorial claims or imperial ambitions. It is, in short, a happy story, with the consequence that Germany will go its own way, even when that displeases the United States. Egon Bahr, a Social Democratic Party foreign policy analyst, who was a chief advisor to Chancellor Willy Brandt, said, "Now the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, so logically Europe can only get its emancipation vis-a-vis the United States." Otto Schily put it this way, leaving aside the question of who was right on Iraq. There were arguments on both sides. The fact that we didn't simply follow the American position was a very big difference for German policy. We have a mature relationship now, and sometimes a relationship between a father and a son becomes a friendship. And, it might be added, sometimes it becomes a rivalry, and sometimes a little of both. Richard Bernstein is chief of the Berlin Bureau of the New York Times.